This is Confessions of a Book Collector. I'm your host, David Headley, and I'll be exploring all aspects of publishing and book collecting, interviewing best-selling and upcoming authors, and sharing insights on inspiring books, both new and old. Welcome back to Confessions of a Book Collector. Today, Agatha Christie is going to be spoken about with some detail. Agatha Christie is known throughout the world as the Queen of Crime. Her books have sold over a billion copies in English, with another billion in over 70 foreign languages. She's the most widely published author of all time, and in any language, outsold only by the Bible and Shakespeare. She's the author of 80 crime novels and short story collections, 20 plays, and with 6 novels written under her name of Mary Westmacott. And the reason why I am talking about Agatha Christie today is because I'm delighted to have a guest with me. I've got none other than Dr. John Curran with me. He is the longtime literary advisor to Agatha Christie's estate, often giving talks and appearing on documentaries about her life. He has spent the last few years unpicking her notebooks and deciphering Agatha Christie's handwriting for his 2 brilliant books, which he'll talk about. And he's also written a third book that's not about Agatha Christie, which we'll talk about later on. But Agatha Christie is certainly an influential author in my life. And I thought it would be interesting to talk to John Curran about Agatha Christie, just because his knowledge is phenomenal. His 2 books are so, so interesting and so very detailed. And I learned a lot about the Queen of Crime through his books. Welcome, John.
Thank you, David.
How was that for an introduction?
It's very subtle.
I know you're not very forthcoming in doing these kind of things, because I know you're a very shy character, aren't you?
I am.
But you love Agatha Christie.
Absolutely. Always did from the very first time I read my first Agatha Christie.
And do you know which one that was?
Peril at End House. Still one of her best. It's in my top 10.
Really? So you have a top 10 of Agatha Christie books?
Well, I have a top 10. The order of the top 10 changes as I read and reread. But Peril at End House would always be in the 10. Because it's not one of her big, well-known ones with stunning plot developments. It's just a really excellent example of golden age detective fiction, which is what she did.
But have you got a favourite Agatha Christie?
Yes, I do. When I published the first book and I did one of these, I was asked a really interesting question. What is your favourite Agatha Christie and what's the best Agatha Christie? Because as the questioner said, they're not necessarily the same. So my favourite Agatha Christie, just from the point of view of readability, would be And Then There Were None. But the book that I think was the best book she ever wrote is 5 Little Pigs, which is not a high profile one. But for me, it's the nearest marriage of novel and detective novel that Agatha Christie wrote. There are only 5 suspects, the 5 Little Pigs of the subject of the title. And she goes to great lengths to illustrate these characters with a lot more depth than Agatha Christie is normally credited. But also in her notebooks, every single aspect of that book changed from the beginning, the early notes. The characters, their relationships, their names, the murder method, the motive, everything changed. And it just brought it home to me that these books that millions of people all over the world find so easy to read for so many years, Agatha Christie worked and worked and worked to make them easy to read.
It is fascinating to hear that. And actually, because I've read both of your books, I loved them so much because they were so informative. I just remember reading about Death on the Nile and then realising that in her notes, because I think there's an illustrated photograph of her notes where Marple was crossed out. Mm. It was never meant to be a Poirot story.
Well, the way I described the notebooks in one of the books, she used them as a sounding board. She scribbled down thoughts as they came to her, and she says in her autobiography, a thought might come to me in the middle of dinner, and I'll just reach for a notebook, write it down, and then go on with my dinner or my whatever. So the idea, for instance, as you say, of Marple, that just occurred to her one day and she wrote it down. And she said, when I go to write the book, a lot of those details might, or in fact, will change. That's why I described them as a sounding board. She just wrote down everything that came to her and then she decided later on. And the later on might be 5-10 years later. But she makes an interesting point. She said, sometimes when I'm looking through an earlier notebook, looking to prepare next year's Christie for Christmas, as it was known, she said, I'll see a note saying, two girls, stamp, hotel. And she said, I have no idea what I meant when I wrote that. But, and this is the interesting point, I think, she said, it may spur me on to come up with something else. And as Christie fans know, she used the same idea quite a few times throughout her novels, short stories, and even her plays. But she always came up with a new twist. And in fact, when she adapted some of her books for the play, for the stage, she changed the killer and she changed the ending. So it was her phenomenal imagination that is the secret of her success.
It's fair to say you're probably her greatest fan. So your first book, Agatha Christie's The Secret Notebooks, is your first book.
Yes.
And the second book is called Make...
Agatha Christie's Murder in the Making.
Murder in the Making.
Because originally there was to be only one book, but I realised there was so much raw material that the publishers suggested I do a second one, which I gladly did.
And there are 120 short stories?
Roughly. Somewhere between 120 and 150. The problem with Christie's short stories is she sometimes published what is essentially the same short story, but she turned it into a novella and gave it a different name and added a few characters. But it is, when it's all boiled down, it's the same. And of course, she published some stories under different titles. So it's very difficult to give an absolute number that you can stand over.
And when did you start thinking about deciphering these notebooks? And how did that come about? When did you find these notebooks?
Well, her nephew, I got to know her nephew, Matthew Pritchard, who at the time was looking after her literary estate. And I met him in Calgary in Canada because I had flown there to see the first ever performance of an Agatha Christie play. And Matthew was staying in the hotel as well. And I got chatting to him. And eventually, when we were breaking up, I said to him, is there any chance I could wrangle a visit to Greenway House, which was Agatha Christie's home in Devon? Because I knew that the National Trust were about to move in and turn it into a tourist attraction. So Matthew invited me down a few months later and brought me all over Greenway House and then said to me, we came back to the hall and he said, now you go anywhere you like and look at anything you like. So that would be like telling a drug addict to help themselves to the chemist's shop. So I spent 24 hours in this tiny room at the top of the stairs in Greenway House, because everything to do with Agatha Christie's literary career was there. Notebooks, manuscripts, typescripts, letters, contracts, programmes, film posters. Not in the remotest order, I might add. So it was then, I mulling it over when I came home, I was thinking, well, if I found all those notebooks fascinating, because I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning reading them, I said, there'd be thousands of others too. So I approached Matthew and he said yes, and I approached HarperCollins, because they were her publishers since 1926, and they said yes, and the rest is history.
She was only ever published by HarperCollins, wasn't she?
No, her first six books were published by Bodley Head, and then it was a very bad contract, and she got a new agent, Edmund Cork, and he negotiated a new contract with Collins, and she stayed with him ever since. Not an entirely unrocky relationship, as for instance when they put Poirot on the cover. She hated any picture of Poirot on the covers. And on one infamous occasion, advance copies of her book hadn't arrived before she went on holidays until she got to Heathrow and found advance copies in Heathrow on sale in the bookshop in Heathrow. But by and large, I mean, they did look after her because she was obviously their most lucrative
of course
author.
I'd forgotten actually that the first six books were published by Bodley Head, but they're now, so very rare.
And they're now published by HarperCollins, and have been for quite a while. But you know, you're right, they're very rare.
So you got an agreement from Matthew to transcribe those notebooks?
Yes.
And how long did that take you?
Well, it took me 6 months of just doing nothing but transcribing, because God bless Agatha Christie, but her handwriting is even worse than mine. And it was... oddly enough, and I think this is odd, the older she got, the more legible it became. I would have thought that the older you get, the less legible. But anyway, in her heyday, which was roughly the mid-20s to the mid-50s, her handwriting was atrocious. It took me... there are still one or two phrases that I can't transcribe, but I transcribe every page of every notebook, which is about 8,000 pages.
Wow.
But then... when I did that, I still had to piece it all together, because one novel could be spread over 12 notebooks, because she just jotted down an idea when she had it. But I think that's part of her success, the fact that she wasn't organised. her creativity was given full rein, and that's how she did what she did for so long. And I think even when she repeated some of her ideas, I don't think she even knew she was doing it.
Right, because she'd written that many books, or?
Well, yeah, yes, she had, and short stories. And I've even seen a letter that she wrote to somebody referring to my book, The 420 to Paddington. Now, as every self-respecting Christie fan knows, it's The 450 from Paddington. But this was a letter written 3 or 4 years after the book was published. So I think she just wrote a book, sent it off to the publishers, and started to work on the next one. Because she published at least one book a year. 1934, she published 5 books.
Wow, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
How come?
I think it was because she had so many ideas. Now, two of those books, Murder on the Orient Express was one.
Wow.
Two short stories, two collections of short stories, a thriller, and Mary Westmacott. And for most of her creative life, certainly in the 30s, 40s, and into the 50s, she was working 2 years ahead of herself. So a book that was published, we'd say, in 1943, would have been received by her agent in 1941. And she did say that being at home on wet weekends or wet months or even during the war was perfect for writing because she had little or no distraction. But people tend to forget that we all know that there's shelves and shelves of Agatha Christie's, but that meant that woman worked to produce those books.
Absolutely.
But of course, books were shorter, 250 pages, because no book was ever improved by adding 500 pages to it, I've always felt. They're just
crazy. You don't like long books, Angel?
No, I don't. Well, Agatha was obviously doing something right. Every single
Absolutely.
One of them is still in print in various languages all over the world.
But she was a foundation to very many of us.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've yet to talk to a crime writer, modern crime writer, who doesn't say, oh yeah, I read Agatha Christie. But she is one of those authors that when you stop reading Enid Blyton and the Hardy Boys and Billy Bunter or whatever, you move on because she's safe. Even though she's writing about murder, there's nothing frightening or terrifying.
No, they weren't gruesome, were they?
No, absolutely not.
Though, going back to the Death on the Nile, when she decided that she was going to make it a proro, you and I discussed this earlier, you felt that she might have made that decision just because there was a cutthroat.
Well,
that would have been too gruesome for Marple?
Well, I think it would, yes. But I think in general, her detective was decided by the type of book she was writing. So fans who know her work well will realise that the Marple stories are far less complicated than the Poirot's. Very few of them have lists of clues and timetables of murderers' movements and what have you. Poirot does that. Marple didn't. And of course, by the time of Death on the Nile, Marple had only appeared in one novel. And there was a 12-month gap between the first and the second Marple novels. So the chances are she had no intention of making Miss Marple a series character.
Right.
Because 12 years is quite a long gap by any stretch of the imagination. So, but also the whole idea of the Nile. Miss Marple solves only one murder abroad, a Caribbean mystery.
Yes.
Whereas Poirot has been, well, he's a traveller before he arrives in the UK because he's Belgian. And then for his second case, he goes to France, solves the murder on the links, and then he travelled extensively. He actually visited Ireland at one stage.
As all good people do.
Well, he wasn't impressed, I'm afraid.
Oh, really?
It was a very bad hotel in the west of Ireland.
Going back to Caribbean Mystery, because I had forgotten that I was a Marple, because I always thought that Marple never, ever travelled. And that's why the reason that I was so surprised about the Death on the Nile is because she'd never travelled. So she was... Yeah, I'd forgotten about a Caribbean Mystery.
Yeah, no, you're right. That was the only travelling she did. But then I always maintain, and this is a little bit sacrilegious, but I think it's completely defensible. Death on the Nile is wonderful, but it could also be Tragedy on the Thames. Because the actual mechanics of the murder doesn't really matter. But of course, the stunning backdrop to Death on the Nile, the Sphinx and the pyramids. And you have to remember, while we can decide to fly there for lunch and back again, the vast majority of her audience in those days were never going to see the Nile or the Sphinx. It was as remote to us, to them, as Mars is to us.
Right. But she was travelling to places like Mosul.
Right from her childhood, Agatha was an inveterate traveller, because actually when she was literally a child, the entire family decamped to France for 3 months. And she says in her biography she spoke very little because she hadn't got a word of French. But throughout her life, she loved travelling, and she travelled right up to the time she was an elderly lady. And I mean, I.
But her second husband was an archaeologist, right?
Her second husband, she met him when she was travelling because right. he was out on a dig and she travelled not to meet him but to meet somebody else on the dig whom she knew. But I always think in the mid-1930s, Agatha Christie got onto a train in Victoria on her own and travelled by train all the way across to the Middle East. Took, I don't know, a week, 10 days at the time, on her own, which I think was quite an impressive undertaking for a young woman in those days. But she loved travel, and it's amazing to read about when she travelled and when she lived on the digs, which she did for 3 months of the rest of her life every year. She lived in this magnificent mansion in Devon, Greenway House.
Yes, I've been. It's amazing.
It is amazing. But then when she went to the digs, she slept in a sleeping bag in a tent, and she describes at one stage the field mice having the Olympics back and forth across her sleeping bag, and it didn't knock a feather out of her. She loved it, and her love of that life comes through her semi-autobiographical Come Tell Me How You Live in 1946. So she wasn't just going through the motions because she loved Max Mellon. She absolutely loved that life, and of course she used it as the background for some of her books, which none of her contemporaries were doing.
No.
She was very, very exotic.
And she was, I think, if you think about the murder of Roger Ackroyd, I can't remember, and you'll correct me, because obviously you
That's
will.
That's what I do.
And I love being corrected by you, because you're so knowledgeable. And it is amazing, your knowledge. It is profoundly impressive. Had anybody written the denouement in the way that she did of murder of Roger Ackroyd?
We have to be very careful when we're talking about
this.
Yes,
there's no spoilers.
Well, if you read histories of crime fiction, there are hints that other people had done it, but she was the one who did it most brazenly and most fairly. I mean, when you go back, as I have done on numerous occasions, knowing the solution, if you go back and read the book, right throughout, from the first chapter onwards, if some sentences or phrases or throwaway remarks can be read differently when you know the answer. So she played absolutely fair with the reader, because that's what she did throughout her life. That was the whole purpose of the type of book she wrote. Anyone can write a book in which you produce the next door neighbour's first cousin's postman as the murderer. But to do it with somebody whom you've lived through the book with, that's what she tried to do. So in Roger Ackroyd, she did that the best she ever did, the best anyone else, because few other writers have done similar plot devices, but none of them were as convincing. And of course she did it again 40 years later.
In which book?
Endless Night. But she did it in such a totally different way that very few people
would have put them together. Right. And that's why I can't remember. I must go back and reread it. I've read all of Agatha Christie's, but I read them such a long time ago. I devoured them all, as like we all did. And actually, in Murder of Roger Ackroyd, she does tell you the solution.
She does, yes.
But anyway, we won't dwell on that because I don't want to spoil any more for people. It is fascinating. And if you're listening to this podcast, if you're not very familiar with Agatha Christie, go and read John's books, just because they are fascinating. And they will just inspire you to want to read more and more Agatha Christie's, because I'll go back and revisit them, because they're so, so entertaining and informative and brilliantly done. How long did it take you to write them?
Well, the transcription was the biggest part, but that was the same transcription that worked for both books. But the actual text was about 6 months. But now that was working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, because as I said to everyone, including my publisher subsequently, it was a labour of love, and I'd have done it for nothing in the first place, because I just was having such a good time, because these were books that I'd loved. And there I was looking at the mechanics behind them in the creator's own handwriting. So it was a fascinating glimpse. But when I was writing...
And unique. There won't be very many other people that ever get that opportunity.
No, absolutely not. But when I was doing the book, or before I set out to do the book, I said to myself, first of all, I wanted to make it accessible. There's no point in writing a book that's very literary and academic, because that's going to militate against it. But also, I wanted to put on almost every page something about Agatha Christie that wasn't known theretofore. And I like to think I achieved it.
You did, absolutely. I love them, and I want more. And I know that there's a short stories that we don't know very much about, so hopefully that might be something that you'd look at. You've done the plays?
I didn't do the plays, but Julius Green did a wonderful job on the plays. He's produced her plays for years, and he did a lot of research and turned up a lot of information.
Is that in the public domain?
Oh, yes, yeah.
He wrote a book about it,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And what's that called?
The A Life in Agatha Christie, A Life in Theatre.
And when did that get published?
About 6-7 years ago.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Because Julius knew the plays inside out because he was involved, right from the word go, in producing a lot of them, and does still to this day. I've just been at a radio adaptation performance of one of her stage plays, where they did it as if they were doing a broadcast on BBC.
So you said at the beginning you went to Canada to see one of Agatha Christie's plays, but The Mousetrap's been on at the theatre here for 70 years?
Well, 70 years, provided they discount lockdown. 70 years this November. But this play I went to Canada to see had never been performed before.
Right.
It was based on her very early novel, The Secret of Chimneys. And she alludes to it in her biography in a sort of a roundabout way. You wouldn't recognise it if you didn't know what she was talking about. But it landed on the desk of a theatre director in Calgary, in a theatre which only mounted crime dramas. So no more than myself, when I found the notebooks, this man thought he'd died and gone to heaven when this Agatha Christie play that no one had ever heard of landed on his desk. So Matthew, the grandson, gave permission. And the man in the theatre had been in touch with me, and I thought to myself, well, 4,000 miles to see a play. But then I just said to myself, well, if I wake up the morning after the first night in Dublin, and it had been, I'll regret it for the rest of my day. So the only way not to regret it was to go. So I flew 4,000 miles, and that in itself was a talking point in Calgary, to say, you flew 4,000 miles to see a play? Well, I did. And the sad fact was, it's not a very good play, but it was an unknown Agatha Christie play, so that was enough for me.
Not a good play because it's Agatha Christie's fault, or it wasn't performed very well?
Oh no, it was performed very well, very professionally, and the setting and the costumes and all of that were fine. But the book itself just didn't lend itself to adaptation for the stage in the standard format. You know, early on in the play, one of the characters has to stand and tell you what has happened up for the 40 pages of the book, but that doesn't sound well on a stage. But it was packed and it's appeared. They did it in the UK in the Pitlochry Festival in Scotland, and I went to see it again there. But it's not a typical Agatha Christie play in the sense it's a bit of a thriller as well.
Right.
But, I mean, it was wonderful to think that here's another Agatha Christie play that none of us ever knew anything about.
And so you're going to tell us who the murderer is in Mousetrap? No, I'm joking. That's why it's been running for so long, no one knows. It's just so wonderful to talk to you about Agatha Christie, because I don't know anyone who knows Agatha Christie better than you do. And where did it begin?
Well, I'd always enjoyed mystery stories, so I would have read all of the Enid Blyton mysteries and Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and lots of other series, children's series. And then, of course, I ran out of them. So I would sometimes tell my mother, when I was changing her books, well, they didn't have a Georgette Hare.
So I used to go them from the library.
Oh, yes. They didn't have a Georgette Hare, so I got myself an Agatha Christie. So, I mean, she knew Agatha Christie was quite safe to read, even though I was only 11 or 12. So then I just read and read and read Agatha Christie, because there's no shortage of them. And then people started to give them to me for birthdays and Christmases, and I still have some of those. And then, of course, when I exhausted the supply of Christie's, I moved on and read a lot of her contemporaries. So it just continued, and the more I read, the more fascinated I became with the entire genre.
That's true, because we haven't talked about it, but should we talk about The Hooded Gunman, which is your third book, which is basically an encyclopedia of crime from HarperCollins.
Yes.
Which Agatha Christie was part of that crime club. That book is fascinating and beautifully illustrated too. How long did that take you?
That took me about 2 years, because the book includes scans of every single Collins crime club, and some of them were very difficult to track down, because while the books have survived, a lot of the time the dust wrappers didn't, but we wanted to do all of the dust wrappers and all of the blurbs.
And how did you find them?
Well, a lot of trawling, and I have to give credit to my editor, David Braun. He did a lot of work as well. And friends of mine who would have collected a lot of these, they supplied a lot of the images. But the biggest amount of donkey work was transcribing all of the blurbs, because usually the blurb was quite extensive.
Right. And they wouldn't have been digitized either.
No. But then when I had read a lot of these books over the years, some I hadn't read, and then of course I had the perfect opportunity to reread some of them, because I include notes on not every book, but certainly every writer, and sometimes every book of every writer. But then also giving the whole context of how the Crime Club came about, because to be brutally honest, it was a marketing ploy. It wasn't a club in the sense that your shop has a book club where people sign up and get a book. No, in fact, most people read them through their library, because anyone listening to this who remembers libraries of 30 or 40 years ago, every public library in the UK and Ireland and probably further afield would have dozens of Crime Club books on the shelf, and they were all recognisable by the Crime Club logo of the hooded gunman. And again, they were safe reading. So if you were getting a book for your mother or your father, you knew they weren't going to be outraged or appalled because they were just nice murders.
Nice murders.
Yeah.
And how many books do you think are in that book, your book?
Just over 2,000. They published just over 2,000 books.
We didn't read them all.
Oh, no, I didn't. No. But I would have read probably 3/4 of them. But there are some. I mean, my main area of interest is what's known as the Golden Age, which is roughly from the in between the wars and then about maybe 5 or 10 years on either side. So it would be the Agatha Christie type of book where the reader is challenged to anticipate the solution before the author gives it to them. So they, as the Crime Club progressed, they were the main feature in the early years. But then the editor tried to do, they published 3 or 4 books a month, so she would try to do one of that type, one a thriller and one set abroad, when crime fiction changed to that extent. So I'm not really interested terribly in tough thrillers, but mysteries, because apart from Agatha Christie, they published Niamh Marsh.
I was just going to talk about Niamh Marsh. Yeah. She was overshadowed though, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. But I found in one of my first forays into Greenway, I found a copy of Niamh Marsh's 21st book, which was to celebrate the 21st... Sorry, not Niamh Marsh's 21st book, but the book to celebrate the 21st birthday of the Crime Club. And it was an Niamh Marsh, and she'd signed it to Agatha with blushes.
Wow.
Which I thought was a nice touch.
Yeah.
Because she was the second most popular writer in the Crime Club. But then they did Julian Simmons and H.R.F. Keating, and then latterly they did people like Patricia Moyes, who would be inheritors of the mantle of Christie to a large extent. And a lot of those books are hugely collectible nowadays.
And they don't have that imprint anymore, do they?
Well, David Braun has resurrected it and has republished some of their earlier titles.
Republished, but not taking on new clients.
Well, not new clients, but some books that were never published by the Crime Club or by other writers, and calling it the Crime Club. Although I did point out to him, he's giving terrible nightmares to future bibliographers.
He probably doesn't care. But something of that brand, when we talk about brands in publishing, we all know Penguin, but obviously Crime Club, and then there's obviously the Pan paperbacks. There's so very few brands in publishing, really.
Oh, absolutely. And in fairness to Collins, they had published crime fiction before the Crime Club. They founded the Crime Club, but they just realised that the demand for crime novels was insatiable. And I'm sure it was a pure coincidence, but Doubleday in America had just launched their Crime Club a few months earlier, and they decided, Collins as they were then, decided to follow suit, and it was hugely successful. It ran for over 60 years.
And how long did Doubleday?
Doubleday's lasted a little bit longer.
Really? Yeah. What was that called?
Doubleday Crime Club.
Oh, really?
They had some writers in common, actually, because they were published both in the UK and in America. But it just shows that the appetite for crime is almost insatiable.
It is. And still today.
And still today,
yes,
yeah.
I mean, Goldsworth Books sells a lot of crime books. Yeah. It's our biggest genre today.
Well, and if you look in the Sunday Times bestsellers any week, probably 50% or more of them will be crime.
It's that time in the podcast where I invite you to enter my confessional and confess to the sins and virtues which adorn your bookshelves.
You're a book collector. I have seen your book collection, John. It is huge. Not all first editions, but no. You have a number. Do you have a prized possession within your collection?
Well, it would have to be. I have a few signed Agatha Christie's. Oh. So they would be what I would save in a house fire. But I have about 300 signed editions, many of them bought in your shop, David.
Yes.
But I have always maintained that if I want to read a book of a favourite writer, I don't care if I have to piece it together like a jigsaw. It doesn't have to be a first edition or a second or a third. I mean, some of them now, books are really grotty looking, but I can't get any other edition of them, so I'll keep them because they're the only edition of a writer that I really admire.
But you collected all of the beautiful paperbacks of Agatha Christie, didn't you? Or have you got all of them
the
now?
The Tom Adams.
Yes.
Yeah, they were the iconic Agatha Christie paperbacks, and they did phenomenally well, and they were now the subject of a book. I collaborated with Tom Adams on a book about his covers, and I did the Agatha Christie element of it. So I have all of those.
That's a stunning, beautiful illustrator.
And they are very, very, very collectible now.
They are very beautiful. So people can collect those if they don't can't afford to buy the first edition hardbacks like me. I can't afford to buy the first edition hardbacks.
Well, nobody can afford to buy Christie now. They've just gone into the stratosphere, and no one will be more amazed than she would herself. Because as far as she was concerned, she was writing disposable entertainment.
Right. And a lot of the books that I see are without jackets. People used to throw their jackets away.
I know. Some people...
Those weirdos.
That's what they did. I know. That's what they did. And in fact, the copyright libraries don't have copies. The only library that keeps just wrappers is the one in Cambridge. The others all discard them.
Really?
Yes.
So all of those book warehouses where they store every book that's published, they throw the jackets away?
Yes. Because, well, I can sort of understand it. If you've got a million books, that's a million book jackets. So if you get rid of the jackets, you'll fit in another couple of hundred books. And they're also difficult to look after and maintain. Jesus. I mean, it's sacrilegious, I know. But I can understand the thinking behind it in the first place. But now, Cambridge, a university library, is the only copyright library in Ireland or the UK that keeps dust wrappers.
I could tell you, as a book collector, I am...
Well, it's horrifying. I know, yeah. But then you see, I always draw a distinction between people who collect books as books and people who collect books as stories. Because some people, I know plenty of people who collect first editions and they never read them.
Oh yes, well, there's a few of those as an investment.
Yeah,
no, but no. I collect my books as an investment, but I also read them.
Oh yeah, no, well, you're in that category, but not everyone does that.
Oh, I'm very fortunate because of my job. I read those books before they're published, I collect the books because I love them.
I know, is the difference, because not everyone who collects books loves books.
Though I do have a lot of books in my collection that I haven't read, and I'm starting to worry about space, so maybe those books I'd have to read to make sure that I want to keep it on my bookcase.
Well, yeah, because everyone has to make that decision sooner or later.
But I will never take a jacket off and throw it away.
Oh my God, no.
John, so I know that you buy a lot of new authors. Have you read anyone recently that you absolutely love?
Well, I loved, and it is a throwback to Agatha Christie, it's Magpie Murders a few years ago, because that was, it was not a typical Agatha Christie, but it had a lot of elements of Agatha Christie in it, because the challenge to the reader was spot the villain, or in fact in this one two villains, because anyone who's read it knows there's two time elements moving along. The other one that I thought was very original and very clever lately was The Appeal, Janice Hallett's Appeal.
It's been very successful.
It has, yeah. Told completely through the medium of letters and WhatsApps and text. Not an entirely original concept, even in crime fiction. I can think of two early Crime Club writers, Philip MacDonald and the GDH and M. Cole, the Husband and Wife team. They did that way back in the 30s.
Through letters.
And
diary notes.
And police reports and what have you. And then so, of course, did Dorothy Sayers and the documents in the case. But, of course, they didn't have WhatsApps or texts. So I thought The Appeal was really... I read it in 2 days.
You loved it?
I did. I loved it.
And you know that the... Obviously, HarperCollins had now got a collaboration of, I think it's 12 authors writing Miss Marple's short stories. Are you looking forward to reading those?
I think it's 13, because idea comes from the original, The 13 Problems. Mm. I like the idea, but I'd have to suspend judgment until I've read the stories.
One of the things I'm not familiar with, although I know of the plays, I don't know very much about them. So do you want to talk about the plays?
Yes, because it came as a surprise to me when I did the first notebook. Quite a lot of people would come up to me afterwards and say, oh, I didn't know Agatha Christie wrote plays. I've read all of her books, but I didn't know about the plays. Agatha Christie is a record holder. Well, everybody knows about The Mousetrap, the longest running play in the history of worldwide theatre. And she thought she might get 6 months out of it. But she also, in the 1950s, she had three plays running simultaneously in the West End, still the only woman playwright ever to have achieved that.
Wow.
And in the 1950s, she produced something like eight. She did some new plays, and then she did dramatisations of her existing ones. And of course, Witness of the Prosecution, as we speak, is back in the West End for possibly its third year. And in my opinion, that's the one that she'll be running for 70 years, because it's her greatest play by a long, long way. But she's the only crime writer, full stop, who is equally successful on the stage and on the page. And her plays are produced every day of the week somewhere in the world, mainly in America. They're the go-to play for lots of senior school productions, because even though they're about murder, they're not remotely gruesome or frightening. They're really just a puzzle on the stage. And I often think she must have been the bane of a lot of her contemporaries' life, as if it wasn't bad enough that she was such a phenomenally successful writer. She also had to become a phenomenally successful playwright. And she always said that writing plays is so much easier than writing books, because you don't have to have long-winded passages of description. It's just, you know, John entered and spoke to David, or words to that effect. Whereas in a book, you'd have to describe the room and what they were wearing and what they... So it was much easier to do that, and she seemed to be able to do it with enviable ease. And when... It's also interesting from the technical point of view, because a lot of her plays, when she adapted them, she changed them considerably. She changed the murderer. She removed Poirot from all of her plays and replaced him by somebody else, because she didn't like... Or she made a very... I thought a very wise decision that everybody in the theatre, if they're an Agatha Christie fan, they have a mental image of Poirot, and no matter how good the person on the stage is going to be, a certain percentage of the audience is going to be disappointed. And he was like, well, it's not the Poirot that I imagined. So by having somebody new, a policeman, or in one case a clergyman, act the part of that detective, she overcame that. But it is fascinating to think that she took the same story, the same characters, and came up with a totally different solution. And anyone who hasn't seen or read the stage version of Appointment with Death, I think it's psychologically much more convincing, the killer that she comes up with, and very, very clever.
Than the book.
Right. The book is one of her foreign travel books. I think it's the weakest of them, but the stage version of it, in the end, it's well worth the wait, because she does something very clever and totally original.
And how many standalones did Agatha write?
Plays. Or books.
Oh, books.
Oh, gosh. Off the top of my head, I don't know. But the irony is some of her standalones are just as well known as her Poirot's or Marple's, for instance. And Then There Were None is the biggest selling crime novel in history. And then Witness for the Prosecution is a standalone play.
Yeah.
So,
and then there was Tommy and Tuppence.
Yes.
How many of those?
There are five Tommy and Tuppence titles, four novels and a short story collection. And I've always retained an affection for them, but most people consider them really, really weak. But her second book was a Tommy and Tuppence, right after The Mysterious Affair of Styles. But interestingly, they're the only characters she created who age. So in the Secret Adversary, they just meet and they're not married, and then they get married. And then the next book, they have a family. And then in the next book, they're working in the war. And then in the last book, they're grandparents, and they're clearly elderly, but they're still, as Agatha Christie said, with spirit unquenched. But it is interesting that she ages them, and as they were sort of keeping track with her age-wise. But the short story collection is particularly clever, because in that they set up a detective agency, and all of the cases they solve are in the style of one of Christie's contemporaries. So there's a Sherlock Holmes type story, there's an Edgar Wallace type story, there's a Father Brown type story. And there are some others that are not as well known now, but they're the three most. She captures the essence and the style of all of those writers really, really well, as part of the fact that they're very clever stories. But I'm almost a voice crying in the wilderness, because most people consider them beneath contempt almost, but I've always retained an affection for them.
Well, there is a snobbishness within the literary world about Agatha Christie, but I don't...
I think it comes down to jealousy.
Of course, the biggest selling author of all time.
In the history of the human race.
Yes.
Yeah. And still there.
John, I would literally sit here all afternoon, but I know you've got to go. I love talking to you about lots of things, but Agatha Christie particularly. I know that you're a passionate book collector. Thank you for coming onto my podcast. I hope that people will go and buy your book and learn all about Agatha Christie from a perspective that they wouldn't have known or had the opportunity, had you not. taken the time to decipher that terrible handwriting and those notebooks, but I'm grateful for it, and I thank you for doing this as well.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
Subscribe now and follow Goldsborough Books on socials to keep up to date with our latest news and to learn who will be joining me on Confessions of a Book Collector, your new favourite podcast.